Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're listening to 101.9 Hi FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is Studio Plus 972 on your radio, coming to you from Johannesburg, as we always do, now on a Monday afternoon. Hope that you are doing fantastically well out there, and we're looking forward to spending the next hour with you as we discuss the ins and outs of what is going on in the Jewish world. And there is a lot going on because we have a world historic event currently unfolding before our eyes, and that is the strikes between the United States, Israel, and Israel on Iran. And so we're going to be doing a lot of analysis on that, really trying to get to grips with what is going on and really understanding what the implications might be and where this might go. So, that is the one big thing. But, of course, it's also Purim, which is not unconnected to the fact that several thousand years ago we had a we had an instance where Jews in Persia had to deal with an autocrat who eventually died. So, you know, there is that part which is similar. And so we are going to be talking about Purim, and particularly given what's going on with the current state of affairs, we're talking about the political aspects of Purim and a book that I recommend if you want to understand Jewish life in a political sense in regards to Purim. So we're going to be talking about that. And then we're going to be talking about the very special contribution that South African Jews and a few others have made to the humble Hormantaschen, and that you can eat whilst you are doing various things on your Purim, and I definitely suggest that you do so. And then lastly, if we have a shot, we'll look at the upcoming leadership race with inside the DA and what it might mean for the Jewish community. Now, let's start, though, with the Iranian aspect, because on Shabbos morning, around 8 a.m., we had strikes that had been initiated by the U.S. against Iran with Israeli help. We had been covering this in previous episodes of this show, talking about this particular issue and the fact that America had been building up its forces in the Persian Gulf, some suggesting that it might actually have rivaled the amount of forces that were there in pre-Iraq invasion. And Trump was looking for a deal with the Iranians. However, he had three important things that he wanted to get out of it. The one, no more nuclear weapons or civilian program, because civilian can become weaponized very quickly. Number two, he wanted to have no more ballistic missile productions, because that is the way that you move nuclear material in a nuclear bomb to the place that you wanted. And number three, he was looking for no more funding of terror proxies around the region. And if the Iranians had agreed to that, that would have made them a safe country for their neighbors, and the Americans would have been quite happy for things to go along with it. However, Iran showed no signs of being particularly interested in this and were giving different negotiating positions. And with this amount of troops in the water, ships, planes, military people, missiles, cruise missiles, submarines, it was a serious problem. And so as a result, you had the Americans losing patience. And another thing is that the Iranians' leadership decided that they were going to have an in-person meeting. They weren't happy to have a Zoom meeting any longer. And so they decided to all meet in person. The leadership of the regime met in a palace in the compound. And so this seemed like a good idea to strike. And indeed they did, with an enormous amount of weaponry. And as a result of that, a large chunk of the regime has now been decapitated in Iran. The leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, is dead. His son is dead. The grandchildren, who are not actually children anymore, but they are still grandchildren, they died as well as numerous Iranian officials. And basically, there's been a decapitation attempt by the Israeli and American forces. Now, that the regime is much deeper than all of this. It operates in all sorts of commercial sectors. It's a big part of the society. So you can't just do this by decapitating the Ayatollah. But he really has been the symbol of the revolution. He's the theocratic head. And as a result, it's a massive blow symbolically to the regime, but also to the ability to really direct it in different ways. And as a result, we now have an ongoing sort of war that is going to be happening for potentially the next few weeks, to be perfectly honest. That's what analysts are citing. It's also what some people in the Trump administration are saying, Trump himself. So we're in for a messy month of March when it comes to this particular issue. And this is what we're going to have to be dealing with. So I'm going to be analyzing what comes next after this. What are the implications in America? What are the implications for China? What are the implications for South Africa? Just to give us a little bit of context about what this means and where it is going. By the way, if you are wanting to be part of the conversation, ask any questions or give any comments, 061-895-1019. That is the number to dial if you are wanting to be part of the discussion, and we'll certainly take your comments on what is going on. So let's start with what happened after this. So even though the regime has now been decapitated and is no longer operational at that level, there was plenty of build-ins, and the Iranians have been retaliating against the attacks on them. They have attacked, to begin with, a number of sites that are around them in the Arab countries, so the United Arab Emirates, the Jordanians, the Bahrainis, a number of others. I think about six in total, including also Cyprus, which is obviously not Arab, but all of these places have been attacked. And they've managed to defend themselves, but the Saudi Arabia as well, that's another one. But even though they've been able to defend themselves, some stuff has gotten through. So we've seen images and videos of the Burj Khalifa being hit by this, major hotels in the UAE, major oil infrastructure in Saudi Arabia being hit, and also a lot of interceptions taking place in the process. The Americans have ramped up their response, hitting nuclear sites. They've reportedly sunk nine Iranian naval vessels and have also been going after the ballistic missile attacks. Now, so far, the attacks, particularly on the Gulf states and Israel, have been serious, but not to the same extent that we saw previously in the 12-day war that happened last year in June. So there does seem to be a degraded Iranian response so far from what we've seen. However, missiles have still gotten through. And we've seen some unfortunate incidents of high-rise in Tel Aviv being hit, also towns in Beit Shemesh, missiles landing near Jerusalem, near the holy sites in Beit Shemesh. A number of people were killed. The number being quoted at the moment is anywhere between 8 and 12. And so there is damage being done on the Israeli side. In addition, Hezbollah, who based in Lebanon, had previously not been keen to get involved in the war, they seem to have changed their mind on this and have now gotten involved. So now we're seeing Israeli strikes in Beirut and the Lebanese government trying to curtail Iranian influence, or rather Hezbollah influence in the government, and their attempts to shoot at Israel. So that is another part of the war. As yet, we haven't seen much coming out of Hamas or the Houthis in Yemen. That could still be, as well as proxies in Iraq. That is something that is a, that is an issue that we're going to have to keep a lookout on in terms of the front with Israel. But the IDF and the IAF in particular have now stated that they believe that the skies above Tehran are clear, and that will clear the way for operational movement in the next while. whilst the Americans and the Israelis continue the campaign. So that is the update on the military side. When we come back after the break, we're going to be looking at what might happen next in Iran if we want to see some sort of change, and also how this affects the various geopolitical actors who are dealing with this particular issue. My name is Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
My name is Benji Shulman, and this is Studio Plus 972, talking today about the strike on Iran and where this might leave us going forward, and what we are likely to look out for and need to see upcoming next. So, that is where we are sitting. Just before the break, we described what the kinetic and military actions look like in the war with Iran, and asking ourselves what is actually coming up next. What do we need to look out for? Well, two things that we need to see in coming up to Iran. The one would be, well, inside, let's say inside the regime, as the Americans and the Israelis are blowing stuff up from the air, we're going to need to see if things start changing on the ground. In December last year, there was a lot of protests, and those were repressed, and the security services obviously repressed them. The question is going to be, do Iranians start taking over and organizing and going out and onto the streets? Hard to say, given that even the most brave protesters probably not going to be keen to be on the street when bombs are falling. And also, many people have come out in support, but the regime does have support in some areas, and killing the supreme leader might give them some sort of central focus. So that's one element. And the other element is the question of if the regime soldiers decide that dying or being hung by angry protesters isn't enough, then is there going to be a case where they could maybe switch sides? Trump has offered immunity to those who do start switching sides. It's not clear to see yet what is actually going to happen in that regard. So we will have to watch and see where the Iranian public actually goes on this issue. It could be very, very difficult. And of course, we're struggling to find out what is actually going on in Iran because they've shut off the internet. I did see that one of the channels had been hacked, one of the TV channels, and they were broadcasting messages. So that's an interesting thing. But it would be great if someone could find a way to turn back on the internet, because if you lit that thing up, I think we would see a lot more organizing going on there. And by the way, the internet thing is interesting because MTN is, of course, part of the infrastructure there in Iran, and they have been tasked. They are the minority shareholder there in Iran's cell, and they've had pressure to turn off the internet in that country during these sorts of times. So they have a problem with that issue, and there is a court case coming up this year about MTN's interaction with Iran, which I think will be extremely interesting. So that is on that side. Iran also does still have some options up its sleeve. And in particular, it is the something called Straits of Hormuz. And the straits is a narrow strait sort of towards the south of Iran, where most of the oil that's coming out of the country and other parts of the Gulf actually leaves. And if those straits are mined or if they're closed off, that is something that could start to spike the oil price and start to affect the economy. If the Houthis start to get involved attacking sea lanes and whatnot, this could also be somewhat of an issue. So we're starting to see those potential pressure points, as well as the shooting at Arab allies and Israel and others to start to take place. However, because Iran has started shooting at the Arab regimes, this has actually started to strengthen, at least in public, Arab sentiment towards attacking Iran. In the run-up, the sort of Arab states were kind of speaking out of both sides of their mouths, really. And what they were saying was that, we need peace and de-escalation, whilst at the same time saying to the Americans, look, you can't put all of this stuff in the field and then chicken out. And now they're having to be a lot more aggressive with this discussion. And are publicly saying, so far they're just saying that they will respond. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia basically issued something saying, well, we will authorize force if this keeps happening. I don't think the Saudis really want to get involved here if they can avoid it. But if the Iranians keep shooting, we might find that something else is part of this equation. We have a message in here from Austin Gibbs, who sent us a message. Thank you, Austin. And he has to say, hi, Benji. Is it truly believed that the people will rise up and take back the country in Iran? So I think, Austin, that is the one gazillion rial, which is the Iranian currency, question. And I think that they've tried on several occasions. But, you know, estimates are that somewhere tens of thousands, upwards of 30, maybe 40,000 people were killed in 48 hours in Iran. And so, you know, a lot of those people might very well not be alive anymore to take it over. But, you know, this is not going to help for the economy. It's not going to help any of this. And people are still frustrated and angry. So the real question is going to be, are you going to start seeing counter-protests, which we can't see because of the internet being down? Are we going to start seeing counter-protests pushing back against the security forces? And are the Americans and the Israelis looking to blow up, you know, command and control inside the IRCG and the Basij, who are some of the security apparatus there in Iran? That is something that we are going to have to see going forward. But it is a crucial element. So, yeah, so the Arabs, just to get back to the next point, by the way, thank you, Austin, for that message. If anybody else is listening, 061-895-1019, happy to take your questions and comments on this particular issue. So that's where things are sitting with the Arabs. In Israel, we've also covered it, and we're seeing where things are going in regards to that. And then, on top of that, we're also looking at what are the other implications. So three places that we're going to look. We're going to look locally, we're going to look China, and look America. We can start locally just because it's pretty easy to say. Things started on Saturday. We haven't seen yet huge amounts in the way of response, but the ANC and the EFF and the Muslim Judicial Council have all issued statements, and the South African government. And I have to say that the ANC's one predictably did come out basically supporting the regime, but it was very, very tepid. Like, there wasn't really a lot of stuff involved, but it was, in fact, they basically said, you know, it's like one of these rule of law, international law, don't violate the UN Charter, all of that. We encourage negotiations, like very kind of typically ANC thing. And then a particular thing saying that they are sending condolences on the death of Ayatollah Khomeini, who, of course, they were very friendly with. So that was the ANC statement. And the government statement actually unusually was very, very close to that. Normally the ANC goes a bit more aggressive and the government stays a bit more neutral, but actually the two of them pretty much tracked themselves pretty similarly the entire time, and they are that's kind of unusual. It shows, I think, that the South Africans are annoyed by what's going on. This is an ally, and they don't want to lose friends. But there's an American ambassador in town, and I think that they really are perhaps trying not to annoy the Americans just right at this particular point. So that's my reading of that particular statement. The EFF is more aggressive, and they came out much more strongly. None of the other political parties have said anything yet, although I do suspect that if this goes on for several weeks, that they will be forced into doing so. So that is kind of an important question. One DAMP, Ian Cameron, did come out on Twitter with a statement saying that, like, anyone who doesn't support the fact that the Ayatollah has been removed, given that he tortures people and women's rights and political rights and all of that, shouldn't be trusted, but basically said, like, that's basically not an acceptable way to do things. So that has been a DA response. Also, as you may have heard on the station, the local Iranian community has come out and has really said that they support the strikes, they support Trump, they support Israel. There's a fantastic, fantastic clip going around from the SABC, where the SABC interviewed an Iranian on this topic, and they were clearly expecting an Iranian who was going to give the kind of ANC party line, and this person was just like, no, this is a great thing. We want this to happen, and we're very happy to see that it's happening. And the poor SABC dude was a little bit out of his depth on the whole thing, and that was kind of rather amusing. So if you go check that out, that's worth seeing. The South African Zionist Federation has come out with a statement saying that they do support these attacks because of who the Iranian regime is and the concerns about nuclear, etc. The Muslim Judicial Council have been opposed to it. And in fact, one grouping even did a memorial for the Ayatollah somewhere in Johannesburg. So that is also something which has been going. And I think that you'll see some arguments in the South African press. Twitter is already alight with this sort of thing. It depends how long this campaign goes on for. The South African sort of impact here is really small. So it's the sort of thing that might run for a couple of weeks, but eventually other more local pressing stories, since there isn't actually a proper South African angle, are going to get, I think, more attention. Just depends who speaks. So I'd expect that maybe the American Embassy might release a statement at some point. You might have other local parties expect protests. And I think we need to also be on guard for any suspicious activities that might be happening around communal events, etc. In the next while. The Iranians previously in places like Argentina, for example, have been responsible for attacks on Jewish installations. And given how much the Iranians are active here, that is something which is for the community services and the CSO in particular to be looking out for, but not something that South Africans, Jewish community, can be lulled into. So that is an important problem, and one that we're going to have to take our eye on. But so far, South Africa keeping its head below the parapet. There will be commentary, I'm sure, in the weeks ahead. But so far, so good on the South African response. Now let's look at China, because China is a really interesting one, and one which I think we can get into. Some of them are things I've been thinking about. But if you really want to get properly into the discussions about this, I would suggest you go check out the Hudson Institute. There's a Berber woman. Her name is Zaneb Rahau, I think. That's Rihiuo, something like that. But you can check out. She has a Substack called Beyond Ideology, and she does a lot of really good work. And she's been talking about the Chinese reaction to this thing and why it's important. The Chinese haven't really gotten involved. They keep stressing de-escalation. They don't want to talk about it, etc. But the truth is that after the 12-day war last year, the Chinese were very, very quickly getting back in with the Iranians and helping them build up their ballistic nuclear arsenal, sending in the ingredients needed for the propellant, helping them with air defenses and all sorts of things. And the reason for that is primarily that the Chinese get oil from Iran. The reason that Iran is able to escape sanctions on its oil is that is that it sells it to the Chinese at a discount. So China gets cheap oil. Iran gets a friend in the international community because it doesn't have too much else. It does a little bit of work with the Russians, a little bit of work with the North Koreans, but the rest of the world really doesn't like it. So this is an enormous problem if you're an Iranian. And as a result, they've worked very closely with China. And for China, Iran is very, very, very useful, right? It's right there threatening American interests in the Middle East. And every single time it threatens American interests and America doesn't respond forcefully, then those countries like the Gulf states start to look around for other partners. And invariably, those other partners are China. Then, in addition to that, you have the fact that you have the oil. You also, the Chinese can start to sell all their technology and their surveillance technology like they have in China over their own populations. They can sell it into Iran so that Iran can check its own population and can check out and prevent any kind of protests like we've been seeing. So the Chinese, for the Chinese, it's really great. And the long-term issue for China and the reason why Iran is important is that it can weaken the United States at a time when the Chinese might need. So we've spoken about the oil, for example, so it can shut off the oil. It can fire on American assets in the region. And the doctrine in American policy is that the American army should not be fighting on two fronts at once. And so for the Chinese, what they eventually want is to take back Taiwan, which is a sort of rebel province. That's what they call it. They call it the rebel province. But basically, Taiwan happened as a result of the war, the internal war between the Chinese nationalists and the Chinese communists in the early part of the 19th century. And China has always wanted to take back Taiwan and thereby not just extinguish an ideological foe, but also to basically create itself as a hegemon in the Pacific. And the Americans have sort of never wanted this to happen because it would be just bad for them, also because they don't like the Chinese and they do like the Taiwanese. And so as a result, it's something that is coming at some point, potentially, if the Chinese feel like they can do it. And so the Americans are trying, I think part of this thing is to create a situation where they can have a lighter footprint in the Middle East. They don't have to fight all the time, and they can deploy forces and put stuff around the Pacific and ward off any potential Chinese attacks. And so China is an extremely important actor here. And if this thing goes the right way and you end up with an Iran that isn't a threat, then you might have not just a calmer Middle East, but also a calmer Pacific. So it's actually a really important question. Even to going so far as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, right? If you can imagine what Hamas might have been like if it wasn't being funded by Iran all the time, even if Palestinian society was exclusively made up of Nelson Mandela's and Mother Teresa's, you would still have problems of security if the Iranians were still involved. So if the snake, so-called, can be cut off, the head cut off the snake, then this would be very good for everyone and it would be good for the Americans to deal with the Chinese. Now, after the break, when we come back, I'm going to be talking about the Americans and what it might do in the domestic realm of American policy, this particular war. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and welcome back to +972 Studio. What we're talking about, and what we're also talking about today, is what is going on with the strike on Iran, and then we'll be talking a bit more Purim-related stuff coming right up after that. So the other question is, how is this whole thing going to play in America amongst the base? The Democrats have already come out against it. They're saying the U.S. Americans didn't get authorization through Congress, and they're very upset about this. But also Trump's MAGA base, I think, is a little bit nervous They don't like this sort of thing. They are Trump. Trump basically was elected on the idea that he wanted to end wars and stop meddling. And it's been a big pitch. He keeps asking for the Nobel Prize for all the wars that he's prevented. And the truth is, I think that if this goes well, then maybe we will be able to give him a Nobel Prize, but just probably not right at the moment. And whilst he has been involved with a couple of other things previously, including the Venezuela thing, which assuredly was not isolationist, but also Operation Midnight Hammer, where last year also buried the previous part of the nuclear project of Iran. Trump has not really gotten too involved in too much kinetic action around the world. And I think that people confuse Trump and think that he is an isolationist, but he really isn't. Trump is what one guy I've read called a Jacksonian. And what that means is that they don't want to get involved in big wars and spread democracy and all that sort of thing, but they also don't like American enemies, and they do like proper American allies. And you can see this kind of idea now. So the Iranians, they kept going after Trump, belittling him, saying he was an idiot, saying they weren't scared, saying they were going to assassinate him. Like, that's not how you deal with Trump. And then also backing that up with some serious background in terms of serious military buildup. And so that, in the minds of conservative Trump supporters, is grounds for being smacked across the face, which is now kind of what's happening here, right? But the isolationist wing of this MAGA movement does not like that. Now, so far, everything has gone fine. The GOP has been on side. There's no one calling him out other than the normal sort of libertarian types who already don't like him. So far, so good. But it hasn't been enthusiastic either, and we're only on day one. So if this goes on for several weeks, this might start to affect Trump at the polls. A lot of people, I saw one statement from some minor fringe Jewish group claiming that that Trump has gone to war to improve his image. I think that that's wildly stupid, because the one thing you don't do as an American president is bring back American servicemen in body bags, which is, you know, we've had a couple of die already. And so this is a considerable risk for Trump. If it goes right, I think it could be very, very good for him in the midterms, although I don't think that foreign policy is going to be really what Americans are talking about particularly, but they are. But it is a different problem in regards to actual big fighting and winning, right? If Trump can be seen to be winning, that's all he's interested in. That might actually affect the midterms even marginally, as long as he can get his economics right and some of his other stuff correct. But if it goes badly and he starts to get abandoned, that could be a big issue. And the truth is, it could be a big issue for 2028. If this goes really well, then the Don Roe doctrine of the fact that they're trying to stop up the holes in American defense, Greenland, Venezuela, Iran, so that they can start to deal with China, if that gets supported, then you might find that the more interventionist GOP members like Marco Rubio will successfully get through, if not more like the J.D. Vance's. So this might go on to have a serious effect when it comes to American politics. So there we go. That's your wrap of Iran invasion 2026. And I'm sure we're going to be talking more about this going forward. Now, it is Purim coming up tonight, so I hope everyone is going to be reading Megillahs and getting dressed up and eating Homantashen and all sorts of other things. As a result, this is what is going to be happening in the Jewish community in the next 48 hours. As I've said, very appropriate because it's Purim. Now, have you ever, though, considered that although Purim is an interesting story, it's about God not being present, but it's also a story about the politics of Jews in the diaspora. And so, as a result, it's an interesting book to read at a political level. You've got the king, you've got Haman as a kind of important player. You've got the Jews and how they try and influence the king to change. It's a way of understanding how Jewish institutions operate when Israel is either absent or weakened in the discussion. And that is where that is sort of where we are at. And if you want to think about what that means, then there's this fantastic book that I'd like to recommend. And it's really worth reading. It's quite an old book, about 20 years old, and it's written by a guy who's today fairly controversial. His name is Hatzoni, Yaron Hatzoni, and he's like the Jewish guy that was very, very close to Trump in different years. Early on, he kind of created this idea of the national conservatives as opposed to the neocons or other kinds of conservatives. And it's really, he's the one who's tried to build a kind of Trumpian thought process to the extent that you can do such a thing. But he wrote this book years ago called The Dawn, which is about, it's basically a political reading of the story of Purim and the story of how Jewish politics works and what Jews have to do in order to get God to intervene in the world effectively. And it's really interesting because he talks about the importance of allies. He talks about the importance of raising your voices when there's a problem. He talks about the problem of unreliable leadership and how do you deal with it. He talks about the problem of communal issues and how does kind of communities undermine the leadership or, you know, dealing, you know, with different issues regarding to self-defense. So it's really, really interesting. And it goes through the entire Megillah and actually goes verse by verse and explains what were the political implications of the actors who were going through that and how it actually worked. So a great book, and I highly recommend it. It's called The Dawn by Yaron Hatzoni. And if you really want a different perspective on Purim, I would highly recommend it on 101.9. High FM.
High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
I'm Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 High FM, and you're listening to Studio Plus 972. And we are continuing today with the Purim theme, and something which you might not be aware of the particular thing that South African Jews helped to contribute to Purim in the world, which I think is just something to be happy about. And I didn't actually know about this, to be perfectly honest, until someone from the UK actually came and started highlighting for our community something about the way that we eat Hormantaschens, which is something that I wasn't aware of, and perhaps you weren't aware of, but what you might be aware of is that you get two kinds of Hormantaschens. You get the big doughy ones, and those are filled with all sorts of different things, and cheese, and mon, and chocolate, and custard. And then you get the biscuit ones, which are harder, also filled with stuff, and have a different quality altogether. Now, in South Africa, you get both, but the main one you get are the big, chunky, doughy ones. But those ones actually don't really exist in a lot of other parts of the world, which I just thought was absolutely fascinating. And as a result, you get these ones that are like cheese, and people who've come here who don't get the doughy ones are very excited about it. Apparently, the origins of this is that the Sephardim have they used to do a fried thing, which was a kind of fried thing with honey in it, which was kind of a Hormantaschen. But the Hormantaschens that we know are an Ashkenazi innovation, and they sort of come out of the Middle Ages, the 1500s, and they very much are a German creation, and were very, very popular for a very long time, and had different and had the poppy seeds in it, the mon. That's the traditional way of eating it, because those were considered to be a sweet treat. Obviously, sugar was less available back in the day then, and so mon was a sweet treat for people to eat. But then over time, we had the invention of baking soda. That's in the 1840s. And as a result, baking soda meant that you didn't need to deploy yeast to get the dough exactly right out of the Hormantaschens. And so because of that, we had this scenario where people who are wanting to make things that are more biscuity, more hard, that can be done weeks in advance. It doesn't really go off. The biscuit ones become much easier and much more economical to do. And especially into the 20th century, as the U.S. got more and more Jews, and as it became many, many Jews to feed, that became difficult for them to feed, all of the old dough ones. So the cookie ones, the hard biscuity ones, sort of became the mainstream first in America and then in Israel. But in smaller communities where you can still feed people doughy hormantaschen, the tradition has lived on. So go out there, reclaim your tradition, eat a hormantaschen, and enjoy Purim. And it brings us to the end of the show for today. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to everyone who helps put the show together. Mukundi, Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons, Vusi on the sound. Dylan Berger occasionally also does something. And to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week, do join us next week on the Plus 972 Studio 101.9 High FM.